So, this all seems horrible.
It was bad. It had nothing, no fire, no energy, no nothing.
God help me.
Hello, and welcome to Upon Second Viewing, the podcast where we give another look to our favorite filmmakers' worst-reviewed films and find out what went wrong, or if it was really as bad as they say.
Supposedly, Cousteau and his cronies invented the idea of putting walkie-talkies into the helmet. But we made ours with a special rabbit ear on the top so we could pipe in some music.
The Belafonte, home to Team Zisu. Skilled crew of deep-sea divers, adventurers, documentary filmmakers.
Action!
Led by internationally renowned oceanographer Captain Steve Zisu, expert on every aspect of marine life.
Swamp leeches, everybody! Check for swamp leeches! Nobody else got hit? I'm the only one? What's the deal?
You just heard a clip from the trailer for today's episode number one pick, and damn it, I am excited. Are you excited? I hope so. To get things started off properly, our first guest is my podcasting collaborator, co-conspirator, co-founder of the pod, Carson Higgins. He's the head of the Filmstruck Film Club page on Instagram, as well as the new podcast, The First Rule of Film Club, which you can find on all podcasting platforms. So that'll be great talking to him today, because the filmmaker Carson chose for our first episode is none other than the great Wes Anderson, with films like Rushmore, Fantastic Mr. Fox, and The Grand Budapest Hotel under his belt. He's one of our most original and highly praised filmmakers working today. But to remind you, we're revisiting the worst reviewed movie of these filmmakers' careers. So looking at both Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic, the Wes Anderson film with the lowest rating is 2004's The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Now, I went into this rewatch with pretty fond feelings for this movie. In fact, it was recently a recommendation on the Quarantine Film Club page, a parody slash tribute to Jacques Cousteau. Anderson's fourth film is also his first time sharing screenwriting credit with frequent collaborator Noah Baumbach. While its slight departure in tone from his previous works, edging slightly towards surrealism and even stoner comedy, it still manages Anderson's unique visual style. The film does manage real heartfelt, tender moments, mostly between stars Bill Murray, Owen Wilson, and Cate Blanchett. But the movie was still a box office failure and a low point critically in Anderson's career. The film has since garnered significant cult status, and I felt going into this rewatch, it was one of Anderson's sneaky best. Carson, on the other hand, did not. So have our feelings changed? We will find out. Enjoy our conversation for this first episode of Upon Second Viewing. Carson Higgins in the flesh.
That's me.
Well, not in the flesh, I guess, in the Zoomscape.
I'm definitely in my flesh, but I'm also just a voice for people to hear at the moment.
What a voice. What a voice it is. Carson from Filmstruck Film Club on Instagram and the other spaces. Where else can they find Filmstruck?
We're really branching out. We're in franchise mode. We're on the YouTubes, we're on the Facebooks, we're on the Instagrams, and then the First Rule of Film Club podcast just got started as well, which you may or may not have been on all of the episodes.
Yeah, well, this I have been on all the episodes. Well, this is the inaugural episode of Upon Second Viewing, and today we're talking about Wes Anderson's The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, his worst reviewed film in his canon. This wasn't your first time seeing this movie, correct, Carson?
Not my first time. I saw it when it came out. I did not see it in the theater, but I did see it like right when it came out, because I was one of those guys who managed to get a award screener copy that I got to watch. So yeah, you know how it is.
I do know how it is. I used to live with someone whose grandfather was in the Writers Guild or something, because one of his dad wrote, or his grandfather wrote westerns, I think, like novels. And I think a couple of them got optioned for some screen, and he got screenwriting credit. And then he was just for the rest of his days was sent all the screeners every year, and he would just give them to my roommate. So every year I was like, felt I was the coolest kid on campus, man.
That's the best deal.
Yeah, it's awesome. Well, I know from following your Filmstruck Film Club, which you've been running for how many years now?
Dude, we've been doing that since 2018 when it was just me and my one buddy, Ash McNair. What's up, Ash? The two of us got a Filmstruck account,
mm-hmm.
which is a now non-existent streaming service that had, for those that don't know, it was like a bunch of classic films, international films, and a bunch of the Criterion collection.
The Janus films and all that.
The Janusz films were featured on there. But so him and I went to acting school together. And so we've always just kind of shared an affinity for cinema and things that not all of our friends at acting school were interested in, but him and I were. He's since gone on. He's like, him and his best friend wrote and directed a short film that I was in last year with, that David Krumholtz starred in and was produced by Hank Azaria. So like, they're on their way. Ash is doing pretty good stuff. But we were just excited about this Filmstruck thing, and we were like, dude, let's use it almost like a book club, you know, like you pick a movie one week, I'll pick a movie the next week, and we'll just trade off like that and just, you know, kind of talk about what we thought about it. And so then we made a Facebook group to kind of try to get other people involved and also just give us a place to chat, I guess, about these movies. And so then it became really fun to kind of surprise each other each week with like, oh man, that movie was awesome. I'm so glad I finally watched that. Good on you for picking it. Check this out. Let me blow your mind. And so then it became this really fun back and forth. And over the last, you know, whatever, 2 years, we're up into the hundreds of people that are experiencing the Filmstruck Film Club. And so now I kind of do it mostly by myself. Ash he's doing his own thing.
Mr. Hollywood now. So
he's so Hollywood. But no, he still watches some of the movies and we'll chat about them and stuff. But yeah, pretty much I'm picking a movie every week and posting about it. And then I make a little video review. I call it like a solo discussion because I'm hardly reviewing the movie. It's more like,
well, they're very in depth. They're great reviews.
Thanks, man.
And you're just a natural on-camera presence, obviously. So,
hey, you know, it's fun. I have a little sidekick. I have a little like home plant of Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy. So all the reviews are hosted by Groot and I, and we have a great time.
Yeah, no, it's super fun, and everyone should check out your page. I know that you pick, you know, like you were saying, more art house kind of off the radar picks.
Off the mainstream.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Not the stuff you're going to see at the AMC 12 necessarily. Yeah,
like I'm not the first asshole to tell somebody to watch
Badlands,
Battle of Algiers or
no,
that's... Badlands or The Red Shoes, but in a world of, you know, Tiger Kings and whatnot, I feel like it's fun to,
yeah.
Put the awareness out there and let people know that at least somebody's appreciating it out loud.
You have an elevated palate, let's say that.
Why, thank you, sir.
Yeah, so
appreciate it.
Well, funnily enough, Wes Anderson, the director of today's film, eight of his nine films that have been released on DVD have been released through the Criterion Collection. The only one that hasn't yet is his most recent Isle of Dogs, which I could only assume is, you know,
coming down just the around the eventually. Corner.
Yeah, I think he must have some sort of distribution deal with Criterion, or just he loves Criterion as much as you and I do.
Are there very many other contemporary filmmakers that have like their entire filmography on Criterion?
Like their entire catalog? I think Wes Anderson is really one of the only ones that has their whole, I mean, they just released a huge Fellini box set. And
right, but
huge,
I mean, he's been dead since.
Yeah, exactly. There's no one that's
making movies that it's just like every time there
comes that comes to mind is Noah Baumbach, which
which
oddly enough is the collaborator on today's screenplay, which is what I was getting to, is that Noah Baumbach, Wes Anderson, these two champions of Criterion got together for the first time. They would later team up again on Fantastic Mr. Fox. But this is their first time writing together, collaborating, and critics thought it was kind of a mess, which is, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think that, you know, you get two creators, two auteurs in the same room, you would think that only magic would happen. But let's see, I'll read you a couple of reviews here. Jack Matthews of the Daily News said, if there's anything more tiresome in film today than hip irony, it's forced hip irony. And here comes a boatload with Wes Anderson's The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Yikes.
And then Ty Burr of the Boston Globe said, the film's meta fay title alone is an example of why some people adore Anderson and why he drives others absolutely crazy. So
what a dick.
I didn't know whether I should read some of these just because it's like, why pile on? But I I think Wes Anderson's probably gotten over some of the criticism by now, or maybe
forgive
not.
The oceanic pun, but what a shallow attempt to review that movie.
I know, right? You know, and some of the other criticisms of it are that the plot isn't really existent. It's just kind of a series of vignettes with some quirky characters and their how do you say it? They're underperforming, kind of underreacting or non-reacting to things. You know, that's how Wes Anderson characters typically are. Like some like explosion will be happening and they just kind of point and say, hey, look at that.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's for, and there's mayhem.
I find it interesting because we'll obviously explore this a whole bunch more, but just to make it clear, before rewatching this the other night, I would actively tell people that I don't like this movie. It was always my least favorite Wes Anderson movie until he made Isle of Dogs, which I don't hate, but it's just like, you know, when you have only good movies, when you have an okay one, then that becomes your worst movie. But yeah, I always was just kind of like, yeah, Life Aquatic doesn't do it for me. Like I never find myself wanting to watch it when it comes down to like, which Wes Anderson to watch. I'm always going to kind of lean towards Royal Tenenbaums, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Moonrise Kingdom, Grand Budapest, you know, some of the other ones. Life Aquatic was not really the one for me.
You're a latter day.
I'm a latter day Andersonite, but I really appreciated rewatching it, especially because like you and I have been kind of talking about Wes Anderson a little bit lately, and so watching it again, I did get a new appreciation. I was reminded of like the reasons why I didn't love it in the first place, but I grew to a place now where I not only admire it, but I do like find a lot to enjoy in it, and I enjoyed it a lot more this time around than my history with the film.
Well, what do you think of the criticism about his characters just becoming almost a parody of his style in themselves, where they're a little too cute, and or maybe that's just how characters in his Wes Anderson, how people in his universe behave. They're just kind of dry, and that's what you come to expect when you go into one of his movies. But do you think that the novelty of it that was shown in Rushmore, Tenenbaums, has kind of worn out its welcome, or do you still get excited that, hey, let's go spend some time with these weirdos?
I think it's like for me with this one, it seemed a little bit more like by this time around, we the audience are like, okay, man, we know what you're doing, and we like it. We want more of it. That's why we're excited to go see this new underwater adventure with Bill Murray and a bunch of familiar faces and stuff. So I remember being excited, but it's like by the time you're sitting there watching it, it does just kind of feel like he's still trying to figure out his favorite way to make a Wes Anderson movie. Mm-hmm. And so kind of trial by fire. I also think that with this one, he suffered a little bit from maybe having too big of a toy box.
I was going to say, you know, like he spends a lot of time kind of showing off how good of a filmmaker he's become. And I'm not just talking about like the claymation, stop motion,
I really dig. And I did not.
Which was great and beautiful to look at.
Did you know that that was Henry Selick who made all that?
I did not.
Yeah, man. Henry Selick, the guy who directed Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
He did all of that stop motion animation for all of those animals.
Yeah. I mean, all of that is really cool. And the composition of the shots, we've talked about this, that, you know, in the background, there's 2 to 3 little details mm-hmm. in pretty much every one of his shots that ancillary characters or even, you know, big supporting characters are just off to the side, like looking at a map. They're not doing much, but they're just mm-hmm. back there. So there's other things for your eyes to kind of train on that are interesting or appealing or funny or whatever he's going for. Mm-hmm. And in this one, you know, just because it's on a boat with however many characters, there seems to be 5 or 6 of those things in every shot. So it is a little overwhelming at times, just the amount of things there are to look at. And that mm-hmm. maybe draws away from not necessarily character development, the plot, certainly. Like you just kind of don't really care what's going on in the story. Not that there is much of a story to begin with, but
I feel like this is one of those movies that was way more fun to make than it is to watch.
Mm.
Like I bet everybody that made Life Aquatic looks back on it just so fondly because it looks like everyone was having a fucking blast.
And Goldblum's there. I mean, how much fun could, I mean, it's
dude,
it's
Goldblum going to be is so fun. Good in it too. He's, oh my God.
He steals every scene. He's so great.
Rewatching it, I found my favorite line in the movie. Is it too early to hit you with like my favorite line from
it? No, please, we're just talking, baby.
I forget exactly the circumstance, but because Steve Zissou and Jeff Goldblum's characters are like enemies,
arch nemesis,
and he's on Jeff Goldblum's boat asking for a favor or for money, or he needs a tow or something, and he has the dog with him. Mm-hmm. And the dog's yapping or something, and Jeff Goldblum just goes, "What's your dog's name?" And he goes, "Cody." And he gets up and he whacks it and he goes, "Be quiet, Cody."
yeah, hits it with a newspaper.
Yeah, I was just like,
"Cody."
Yeah, there it is. Be still, Cody. I forgot that part, but I remember that I laughed the first time I saw the movie. So seeing it again, I was like, "Oh right, this movie's so bizarre."
Yeah, and he pulls out all the classic mannerisms, Goldblum mannerisms, you know, like the cupped, splayed fingered hand for no reason, where he's trying to explain. It's like the Italian, stereotypical Italian.
I know.
But he's doing. But the Goldblum, he does the whole hand, where he's like, "Let me just tell you something about whatever," and kind of rubs his fingers together a little bit. You're just like, this guy is either the most arrogant bastard or he's just loving life, baby.
And I think he's definitely the latter, man.
I think he's just a happy guy.
He's just enjoying it.
Yeah. If you get a chance, take a look at Goldblum's IMDb picture, which mm-hmm. I'm sure he chose for himself.
I'm gonna look at it right now.
It is something to behold. as far as characters go, this kind of leads me into the second point I wanted to discuss with you. Yeah, there he is.
Excellent picture. Oh yeah. My God.
Yeah. Rainbow sweatshirt, just looking like he's having a grand old time.
Oh man.
Bill Murray in this movie.
Dude,
the titular Steve Zissou.
Yes, sir.
So I want to know which Bill Murray are you taking? Are you taking 80s smartass kind of ladies man, wisecracking Bill Murray? Are you taking broken, introspective, sad, dry, depressed, aged Bill Murray? Because there is a separation. There's Ghostbusters, Stripes,
Caddyshack, SNL. Bill Murray.
Yeah. And then there's Lost in Translation, Broken Flowers. Steve, which is a comedy, but his character is a sad sack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of how you associate Bill Murray these days, is the latter. And I don't know if that's just necessarily because it's more recency bias, but I just remember there was a time when Bill Murray was the, you know, what about Bob, cut up, crack up guy. And I don't think he's really done that other than his cameo in Zombieland,
which is one of the best cameos of all time. Sure,
one of the best ever. But I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he was playing Bill Murray of old, and there was a little bit of nostalgia in that performance that got people.
It was very Ghostbusters Bill Murray.
Yeah, and it got people kind of worked up and like, oh, it's him being funny again and not depressed in Japan.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, do you take your Bill Murray with with a spoonful of sugar or with or black?
So, and like, this is a really silly analogy, but I mean, without the heads and the tails of the coin, it's just not worth its value, right? So you got to take them both. But I will for this.
I was gonna boo you, but okay.
I know I deserve a chance
to save.
I deserve the boo. But I will say I'm a huge, original Bill Murray breakout star fan. Like him on SNL, him and Caddyshack, through like Groundhog's Day is just such a stellar period. But I think that he grew into something far grander. He's turned into this, like, he's the Dos Equis guy of America. Like, he's the most interesting man in the world. He's this kind of man of mystery. There's a documentary about him.
Yeah, that he shows up at people's wedding receptions and dances with the, whatever. And you're like, there's all those like urban legend stories about him. But I think that what's intriguing about that is it's a glimpse back to the fun, carefree cocaine days of fun Bill Murray.
Yeah,
but he's still getting nominated for Oscars for being, Hyde on the Hudson or whatever the hell.
Right. Well, my favorite Bill Murray performance is Saint Vincent, which is
another one. Cantankerous
dude. Yeah. I mean, he's so perfect, perfectly placed in that movie. And to make a very long meandering answer much shorter, I take late Bill Murray.
Yeah,
because I think that he's just a more fuller, more well-rounded actor nowadays, where he was clearly so good at the Bill Murray thing for so long, and it in and of itself evolved. Like Stripes and Caddyshack Bill Murray is not the guy you get in Groundhog Day. Like he's evolved. We're like, that much closer to Lost in Translation.
Well, then Space Jam happens.
Oh, dude, Space Jam. Fuck, man. I forget that he really does just show up sometimes.
My guy works.
Kill it.
What about Bob? Classic. And
I think my single favorite thing about Bill Murray is that he has like famously never had an agent or manager. He has a landline phone.
With an answering machine.
Yeah, that you can call and give him an offer. And if he wants to do the thing, he'll send it to his lawyer. Mm-hmm. And they'll do the contract, and then that's it. And I just think that's the coolest thing in the world. It's like, that's the type of actor I've always hoped I could become one day, is like, just call my phone, man. Yeah. I'll tell you if I want to do it.
So, you know, in all this discussion, I guess I failed to mention that he's in nearly every Wes Anderson movie, and that would be latter day.
Yeah. He's what? He's not in Bottle Rocket. And does he do a voice in Isle of Dogs?
Yes.
Well then, yeah, I think he's in a damn near every single one.
Or he's probably not in Darjeeling.
He's in the very first scene. He's like the first person you see. He's in a little cab.
Yeah. I haven't seen Darjeeling, and I think I saw it in the theater and then I forgot all about it.
Yeah, he's very randomly just like in the one, he's the first person you see in this like little tiny cab ripping through the city. And then we get to the train station and the boys are all trying to get on the train. And then like, that's it.
Okay, so
if I'm not mistaken, we like don't see Bill Murray ever again.
So then I'm guessing that
free trip to India to go hang out with the homies.
Yeah, I guess he must be like a Wes Anderson muse of some kind.
Yeah, he's like the Samuel L. Jackson to Quentin Tarantino, man.
Yeah
just gotta have a minute.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, does this rank at all within his Wes Anderson performances? Sure, he's the main
I think that that's particularly why it moves it up for him. But like in rewatching it, I found a lot in common with Steve Zissou and the dude. I mean, yeah. he's like meaner, right? He has a different set of principles, but as far as like a character we're going to follow for 2 hours in kind of an offbeat comedy, they do kind of remind me of each other, and they are similar vehicles for those two actors. He's off smoking weed and he's like miserable, but
he's like, hey, let's try that. Sure, let's do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's a little more motivated than the dude, I will say that.
Right. And he's
very much so.
And you know, he's like a quote unquote worst person. Like the dude minds his own business a little bit more than Steve Zissou kind of inserts himself into people's lives and fucks it up.
Yeah, well, that's true. So for a review about Murray, Joe Morgenstern of the Wall Street Journal said, there's a lot to appreciate here, especially Mr. Murray's variations on the sad but hopeful soul he played in Rushmore and in Lost in Translation. Yet meanings get lost in a clutter of cleverness. So again, they're talking about how Anderson's a little too cute for his own good. But I think universally, Murray's pretty praised in this performance. I think my favorite of his from the Wes Anderson group, though, I love him in Tenenbaums.
Oh yeah,
the doctor, man. Just the doctor who needs a doctor more than anybody, really.
When he has that guy try to put the blocks together.
Oh yeah, fascinating.
Yeah,
he has a acute sense of hearing. Am I really colorblind? I'm afraid you are. So he's so good.
Man.
Or when he pops in on Margo when she's taking a bath. Just facing the door real quick.
Yeah.
Can I get you something, my darling?
Can I have a cigarette? You don't smoke. So. I don't remember exactly what he says, but.
All right. So I guess that brings us to the final thing, which is where you rank this in Wes Anderson's canon. Do you think this is as bad as the critics are saying?
Well, here's the trouble, right?
Do you want to hear a couple more reviews before we get into that?
But, well, it's, sure, why not?
Yeah, all right. Well, this guy from Film Thread, this is a pretty good one. It says, will ultimately be remembered more for the trademark Anderson look than for any of its characters or any emotional impact. Mm. And then this dude from the Dallas Observer, Robert Wolonski, said, the more technically proficient Anderson gets as a filmmaker, the more emotionally barren his movies become. Oof. So at last, The Life Aquatic drowns in a sea of self-indulgent touches that delight the filmmaker but distance the filmgoer, who wants to love the director and his characters but just can't, not anymore.
Oof,
yeah, I'm like, Jesus Christ, just execute the guy, I guess.
Yeah, seriously, did you bring the bullets?
Yeah, I know. I was like, not anymore. You're like, he sounds like a villain in a Bond movie.
Yeah, geez. I am just now in this moment realizing something that I think is true for me, so maybe it'll be true for other people, but I think this was the fourth film, right? And so like he'd been setting some really nice building blocks. Like I had not seen them in order, right? I think the first one I saw was probably Royal Tenenbaums. Then I watched Rushmore. Then I watched Life Aquatic. Then I watched Bottle Rocket. Like I'm not certain that that's the order, but like I definitely didn't see Bottle Rocket first. But you get that, you get Rushmore, which is like a little closer. Royal Tenenbaums kind of fully realized. And all three of those films are written with Owen Wilson. This one is not. And so I wonder if it's like, because Noah Baumbach and I don't always get along as far as an audience and a filmmaker go. I don't find myself gravitating towards his films very often. They always kind of bum me out.
Yeah, you got to be in a certain mood to be like, I'm going to watch The Squid and the Whale. You're like, fuck, all right.
I know. Like, I really enjoyed watching it the first one time. And like, I look back on it fondly, but I don't need to watch it again. Marriage Story as well. Like, when am I ever going to watch that again?
Yeah, I mean, I
loved it.
I got it just because I bought it because I collect the Criterion stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's in that regard, it is worth it. And it's a spectacular movie. But I guess it's like people at this point were like, okay, cool. I know exactly what to expect when I go see a Wes Anderson film. And then when we went to go see this one, it was very close, but it wasn't quite what we were expecting. It was a little darker. It was a little more Noah Baumbach.
And it was very much more Noah Baumbach in the sense that there's not a flowing plot. There's not a like structured series of events. There are things that happen, but not in an order that necessarily necessitates the next thing. You know what I mean? Like, okay, she and Ned hook up. It doesn't really matter that comes before a certain event or not. You know, it doesn't really matter where in the story it just matters that it happens.
Yeah.
So those other three films with Owen Wilson, each event belies the next. So there's a perpetual motion to the story. And this is just kind of a bunch of quirky people hanging out until they have to go find this shark.
Mm-hmm. Like, I almost wonder who had more fingerprints on the script. Like, is it more of a Noah Baumbach script or is it more of a Wes Anderson screenplay? I can't really tell. I will say that the French influence that's always all up in Wes Anderson's films was like very much, especially in the humor in this film. But he was going through, I guess, like a super Italian phase and made this movie in Italy. And it, when I kind of look at it through that lens, I'm like, oh, it, all your movies are always going to feel kind of French, but this one also feels like there's a little bit of that Italian thing that you're wanting me to see. Like, but I'm getting it. It's effective. Good job.
Yeah. The last the thing that made me that you just reminded me of that I wanted to ask you about is Wes Anderson's use of music in his always just tremendous soundtracks and very, very personal to the specific films. Where does Sao George's Portuguese David Bowie covers, you know, masterpiece fall in with the soundtracks of other Anderson
pictures? So what's I felt it on this rewatch, and it was something I felt originally, where it was like I really dug it as a choice, and I think that Sue George is really cool. And I found out in doing a little research that he translated and arranged all of those covers, which is kind of cool. that, you know, Wes Anderson was just like, dude, I want you to do this. Like, I want Sue George to come and do this. So, yeah. Like, why don't you do it? But sometimes, and I think in the first, because when they're still like doing the premiere of the first documentary, the one that like introduces
the one that half the audiences leaves and everything.
Yeah. We're like celebrating on the boat or whatever. And what was I just talking about?
The Portuguese sound.
Yes, thank you. So if I'm not mistaken, it's like Steve at one point like runs, and like right when he runs, it goes like, this is Major Tom to Ground Control, but in Portuguese, whatever. And it's like exactly the same moment as like Fly Mordecai and the na na na's of Hey Jude happen in Royal Tenenbaums. And so it just felt like a little, I don't know if derivative is the word because it's from your own shit, but it's like, it just felt like I just saw you do this. And so like it didn't feel.
You think it's a director motif?
Yeah, but it felt less like, hey, here's that thing I do, and a little bit more of like just recycling, and maybe they won't notice, or maybe they will notice and they'll like it, like it a lot, and it just seemed
that needle drop moment.
So like it works and it doesn't for me. Like I like it by itself. Like I would definitely just throw it on to listen to for sure. But my favorite part, as far as the music goes in the film, is when he's counting down and you see the pirate ship coming up.
It's so great. Just over his shoulder. And dude, then the ladder comes up and he just
so perfect, man.
Ladder.
So good.
It's another one of those underreacting moments for an Anderson character where he looks over, there's pirates, ladder. They're about to board the ship and he's still strumming the guitar. Just like, oh, this is interesting.
Yep.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely just, I guess maybe it was just too clever for its own good.
Oh, so you see, you're falling in line with the critics.
I'm falling in line a little bit, but it wasn't, it's like I've come a little bit onto the other side where I'm like, there's more that is good. And there's more that works about this movie than doesn't, but the things that don't work really take away from it for me.
All right. So, where is this rank?
Second to last,
with just Isle of Dogs being worse. Damn.
Maybe on the second or this rewatch, whatever time it was, it might eclipse Darjeeling for me. But I do get a kick out of Darjeeling Limited. I don't have any brothers, but like there's something about that dynamic with those three, and particularly the casting of those three guys together as brothers really works for me. And so I would actually
Adrian Brody owes his life.
I know. Yeah. I like me some Adrian Brody, and I love Owen Wilson with all of his fucking bandages and stuff. I think it's probably second or third from the bottom out of eight or nine films.
All right. Yeah. This was pulling in at number two for me behind, Royal Tenenbaums. But after this last rewatch, I think I'm going in the opposite direction, and I'm putting it down a little bit lower. I think this probably falls in behind Rushmore and
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
And Fantastic Mr. Fox.
It's just so good,
man. I like it more than I like Grand Budapest, but that's it's coming in at number four for me. 4 out of 9.
All right. Not bad. That's not bad at all. No. Come on.
All right, man. Well, this was fun.
Yeah, dude. Are you kidding me? This was a great time. Can I tell you some fun facts that I learned about the movie?
Please. You did the research. Sure.
Yeah, man. I did a little bit of research and I found out some fun things. Did you know that the ship that is in the film is named the Belafonte, right? Mm-hmm. And this film has a lot to, or I guess Steve Zissou in general has a lot to owe to Jacques Cousteau, the famous.
Yeah, his character Steve Zissou is based on Jacques Cousteau.
even the red caps, I guess, are like an homage to him. But the ship being named the Belafonte is kind of a cute little homage as well, because Jacques Cousteau's ship was the Calypso.
Oh, yeah.
And Harry Belafonte sang Calypso music. So
the most famous.
Yep. So they named it the Belafonte. Also, Bill Murray became a certified diver while making this movie, logging.
I when I hear little research tidbits that they're like, Val Kilmer spent 3 months practicing his quick draw for Tombstone. I'm like, yeah, wow, that's cool.
That's great to know. Yeah, he logged over 40 plus hours diving.
Huh.
So that's kind of cool. He also had to leave the filming at a certain point to go get a Golden Globe for Lost in Translation.
Oh, okay.
He also had in his contract that he would be able to watch the Cubs in the postseason live.
I did hear that part. I remember that bit of information about him being like a crazy baseball guy like me.
Mm-hmm.
And had it contractually obligated that he can, or contractually that he can watch baseball during shoots. Jack Nicholson has the same thing for the Lakers, but he's retired.
Yeah. Did you also know that this movie came out on Christmas Day?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a Christmas Day release, 2004.
That sounds about right. I want to say that I did see it around the holidays.
Probably a limited release and then went wide like January 18th or whatever.
That sounds about right. That was like the year I moved to, San Francisco. Yeah.
Also, because I wrote it down, I'm going to say this too. It had a $50 million budget and guess what it pulled in worldwide?
I think it was 24.
24 was the domestic haul. Okay, very good, JT.
35.
Yeah, 34.8. So yeah, $35 million is what it made. So it
did
lose some money, lost money, and it wasn't very well reviewed. And goddamn, I mean, the guy definitely got back on the horse.
His next one out the gate was.
Well, he had to get Darjeeling out of his way right after this.
I almost gave up hope on him after Darjeeling. I think that's my least favorite.
I think a lot of people did. I think a lot of people were just kind of like, oh, maybe his one trick pony thing is not sustainable.
But he
turned it around, man. He's one of the best we got,
which
contemporary American filmmaker wise.
Well, that is a great segue to plugging your new podcast, which I was a guest on for several episodes, and one of those we talk a lot about Fantastic Mr. Fox and Wes Anderson in general.
Yeah, we specifically kind of were using Fantastic Mr. Fox as this like linchpin turning point in the career of Wes Anderson, and talk about how it was instrumental in kind of getting perhaps getting him back on track, as it were. But yeah, I had a good time talking to you about that. But yeah, dude, been talking to some people that have heard it and listened to it, and I think they like it. So I'm definitely going to keep doing it. I hope you'll keep stopping by to talk to me.
Oh, absolutely. Well, why don't you give the people what you want. Give them all the plugs.
Check it out, folks. If you're already listening to this podcast, then go subscribe. It's helpful if you subscribe to The First Rule of Film Club. That's the podcast. It's wherever you like to listen to podcasts, you'll probably be able to find it right there. But also, that Filmstruck Film Club that I was talking about earlier is on Instagram, YouTube, there's a Facebook group. So whatever you like to use, that's where I'm always putting that stuff. That's kind of what's up with me, man.
Awesome.
I'm easy to find.
Well, we will be doing another one of these very soon with, I believe, our friend Cume from Rec League. And we'll be talking about This Is 40, the Judd Apatow much maligned entry in his canon. So until then, Carson, thank you very much. We'll talk to you then.
Thank you, man. This was a pleasure.
This was a blast. See you then, buddy. That's our show. Thank you so much for listening. The podcast is produced by me, JT Sondergren. You can find my movie reviews and recommendations on Instagram at Quarantine Film Club or on Letterboxd at Quarantine Film C. You can give both of those pages a follow. Original theme music for the show by Richie Cunning. You could find his work on Spotify and Bandcamp. Just search Richie Cunning. You'll be happy you did. We'll be back next time with more mediocrity from our greatest filmmakers. But until then, remember, you're only as strong as your weakest link.